We're continuing to meet the winners of this summer's state legislative primaries, who either have no opponents or just token opposition in November, and we'll be heading to Albany in January. And our next conversation is with Emily Gallagher, who beat 48-year incumbent Joe Lentil in the Democratic primary to represent part of North Brooklyn in the Assembly. Emily's part of a new class of liberal politicians that have emerged in recent years, who are active in their community and have emerged to take on the Democratic establishment, with a lot of success since 2018. We began our conversation last week by discussing what made her want to challenge Assemblyman Lentil, who hadn't faced a primary since 2010, when he won with more than 80% of the vote.
Well, I think it was actually that very fact. I really think that democracy thrives when there's a conversation about who's representing us and why we've chosen that person. And I think it's really important to be able to clearly share what it is that your goals are in Albany, what it is that are your goals in the community, and why it is that we should want an elected to stay in office. To know that he had been there since 1972 and that he was rarely primaried, and really in the activist circles that I had been working in for the last 14 years, the kind of general conversation about it was, we don't primary Joe, like, he's fine. And I just wanted to see what it would be like if someone came through and said, you know, there's a lot that isn't fine and that we could be doing more. And having seen in 2018 how far to the left this district really falls, and having that being very much my personal set of beliefs, I thought that maybe the district at this point might be interested in someone who was more outspoken for the issues that were impacting the state. So at first I was really hesitant, and it was just kind of like a joke between my friends and I that I was going to do it. And then it became something that I couldn't stop thinking about. And in 2018, I actually lost a dear friend to an opioid overdose. And it reminded me that life is not about making plans for the future. It's about living right now. And if I wasn't willing to stand up for my values and for what I wanted to see happen right now, it was as good as not doing it at all.
What did you see as a path to victory, especially after the Working Families Party, which had backed a number of insurgent candidates, went with Lentil, and the Democratic Socialists in New York City opted to sit out your race?
I have a really strong relationship with the Democratic Socialists. So I had been, you know, a part of a number of conversations, and I knew that the reality was that they knew that this was a district where someone like me could win. And they also wanted to put their resources into folks who they felt could use a boost. So I felt very comfortable going out there on my own. Of course, it was disappointing because it feels exciting to be endorsed by someone. It feels like a validation. But I knew that I had a relationship with the community for a long time, and that, you know, if I spoke the truth about what I knew the community wanted and needed, that could serve just as well. You know, it was scary going out without those endorsements, but I just used my community as my endorsement, and it worked. So our path to victory, you know, we really looked at the numbers from 2018, and we saw that the races where this community showed up the strongest were for Cynthia Nixon, for Bernie Sanders, for Julia Salazar. So I knew that the kind of message that I wanted to share was the same message as those candidates. So we focused on the parts of the community that we knew really strongly believed in those messages. And the rest was very much about just getting the word out. And what I discovered through talking to people before coronavirus hit and then talking to people on the phone was that many people were unaware that, you know, that there was someone who had been in office so long, and that they were unaware that for many cases, people who are very engaged in federal level politics are not necessarily engaged in local or state issues. And so when I started to talk to them about housing justice, about, you know, environmental justice, and then about all of the things that are really impacting us here, and to inform them that that was all controlled in the state, I really won people over. I think there's a whole community that's existed here for over 20 years now that was never really engaged by my predecessor. So I knew that what they wanted was not necessarily being addressed. So talking to them really, really made a difference.
It seemed like in 2018, there was a lot of attention to the IDC and the state Senate trying to oust them. And then in 2020, this focus largely on the assembly. Do you think that in terms of sort of grassroots interest, there's more interest now in state government moving forward? Or do you think that it's been exhausted based on the 2018 and 2020 elections?
I think that we'll see the interest in the state government just continue to increase, because essentially for decades, we as community advocates were told, don't even bother with Albany. It's locked in. It's controlled by political machines. There's no movement there, and you're never going to get anything through. It's a waste of your time. When we saw the Trump election in 2016, people really started to realize how important it was to have a state that could protect and defend and be an innovator with new kinds of progressive laws that would make us feel like we could keep democracy active here and keep our citizens and our residents active. I think we have had a lot of wins since 2018, and it's been such a short period of time that it's given people a real appetite for more. And I'm really excited to see what the freshman class that I'm a part of is going to be able to accomplish now that we're going into the assembly and having an assembly that has a louder voice to the left and having a Senate that has a louder voice to the left. What kind of protections are we going to get for our immigrant brothers and sisters? What kind of innovations are we going to be able to make? So there is a little bit of a shift, but I think we're going to see that for working class and everyday people to survive during this era, we need a louder voice to the left. And I think we're going to keep seeing people awaken to this reality.
We're speaking with Emily Gallagher, who ousted a 48-year assembly incumbent in the Democratic primary this summer and will represent parts of North Brooklyn in January. How do you imagine you and your fellow incoming class of freshman lawmakers will leverage your political power in 2021? Is it voting as a bloc? Is it something else?
I think that we are, you know, very interested in just making sure that we are having active debates about issues, that we're being really aware of how the whole system functions and making sure that it's functioning in a transparent and democratic way. Many of us have problems with the status quo and just how Albany works. So I think a lot of what we're going to be looking to do is to shift the conversation about power in Albany and to really try to give legislature members more power to represent their communities. So that's going to be a big initiative that I think we'll undertake. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of rooms that need a voice to speak for the majority of this state, which is people who are struggling and people who are just getting by. And I think by inserting that voice into a variety of different committees and different issues, it's going to really help push the needle.
Do you think it's possible to disrupt the status quo with Carl Hastie still as Assembly Speaker?
You know, Carl Hastie has been a really friendly and open leader. And I think that, you know, with active conversation and with an open line of communication with him, we'll be able to work together and to, you know, develop a new way of doing work in Albany. I think that just as I was told so many years not to run for a position in Albany, I think that we have to adjust all of our mentalities about how Albany works. And that's going to be done through cooperation.
I was intrigued by your background in terms of sort of the geographic areas you've spanned in your lifetime, growing up in Rochester, going to college in Ithaca, living in New York City for I think like the last 16 years. What, you know, do you think that informs your perspective at all? Do you think that gives you a unique perspective, seeing you have a downstate and upstate, you know, life experience?
Yes, I really, really do. And that was one of the things that got me really excited about a state level position. I was very aware and active and interested in how politics and government worked in Rochester as a kid. In Ithaca, I was politically active, and I chose Ithaca College because I felt that Ithaca really would be a good place for me to learn activism and advocacy. And, you know, and then I know about the rivalries between the areas of the state, and I know the competition that exists for resources. And I also know the culture is very different in these different areas. My brother also went to college in Plattsburgh, so I have some time that I was learning about that area of the state, too. Our state is really culturally diverse. And not just internationally with a cosmopolitan sense of who lives here, but we have very different needs in each part of the state. And I do feel that my experience all across the state is going to help me really reach out to those communities. I'm already planning a trip to go to Rochester and to meet some of the folks who are politically active up there. And really, you know, I think some areas of this state, you know, we're just getting one perspective, right? The dominant perspective. But I know, for example, in Rochester, there's a lot of dramatic things happening right now. And I think having that alliance between downstate and upstate is going to help everyone. And it's a different place. Every single place that I've lived is a very different place. And I'm really glad that I've found a way that I can make use of that awareness. You know, when I was younger, I would sometimes get embarrassed talking to people who in New York City, you know, you have people from all over the world, and they would ask me where I'd lived. And I would list places that were all in New York State with the exception of a year in London, right? And I would start to think, wow, I'm really a New Yorker. Like, I am all about this state. And now that's going to serve me, and I'm really excited for that.
And after a quick break, we'll be back with more from Emily Gallagher, including her take on Rochester's novelty cuisine, the online footprint of millennial candidates, and much more.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.
We're continuing our conversation with Emily Gallagher, who ousted a 48-year assembly incumbent in the Democratic primary this summer and will represent parts of North Brooklyn in January. And before the break, we were discussing your roots in Rochester. So I'm curious whether you have any strong feelings about the garbage plate, the city's novelty food item.
Well, you know, like, I don't know. I have a very sensitive stomach, so I always try to kind of avoid that sort of thing. Same with white hots and things like that. You know, maybe that's why I ended up coming down to New York City. My stomach couldn't handle Rochester cuisine.
Well, are you in Brooklyn though, preaching the gospel of Wegmans?
Oh, you know, I am. And I have, you know, I have just a little bit of a distance that makes it hard to get to Wegmans from here. Mm-hmm. So whenever a friend offers to drive me, it is like Christmas Day. And, you know, I go and stock up on all the Wegmans brand food. And I'm really excited because Wegmans is actually in my district.
I'm curious because you and I are about the same age. I'm 33. And, you know, one of the things that emerged in the final days of your campaign were some immature online entries you published nearly 20 years ago while in college. And so I'm curious, considering how we live in an era where politicians will have digital footprints from growing up, which likely includes some content they regret, how do you think voters should process whatever gets unearthed online? And, you know, should we be held responsible for things we said in middle school, high school, college? What do you think about all that?
You know, one of the things that I was really concerned about before I ran was that I am a digital native and I have been online since I was a kid,
yeah.
Right? And I had, you know, I had a lot of activity online. I was part of all kinds of online communities. I had a GeoCities page, right? Going back to like, you know, middle school. So I think that the reality is that digital privacy is a real concern for a variety of reasons. And, you know, one thing that I find very interesting about what happened to me is that when I had published that live journal, it was locked. And it was content that was only for people who I had connected with online.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is that when we publish things online, we no longer own it. It's owned by corporations who have no concern for our well-being. And I think that's been proven time and again with the kind of struggles with Facebook, right? So, you know, I actually went down a rabbit hole of what happened to LiveJournal that ended up making those posts, you know, publicly accessible, because I had worked very hard to make sure that I had those things locked away when I was a young person. And I think it's really heightened to me the need that we have as a state and as a country to develop some stronger laws around this. And when I'm talking about digital privacy, what happened to me is like not even what I'm talking about. It was a symptom of something much more nefarious, which is data scraping and all kinds of things that are happening. I mean, you know, we've been reading about deep fakes and things like that. I'm very interested in the work of Shoshana Zubkoff talking about what will happen to our identities and, you know, what we have control over in our lives online. And so for me, it was something where I knew that my peers wouldn't really care because we all have content like that. And also, you know, it humanizes me. But I think the other thing is it really reminded me that we have a lot of work to do around internet and data. And we have not done anything in this state to protect consumers. And we are using so much digital technology. It's really important that we start working on that. So it's helped me to realize that this is a priority of mine. And also another part of it is it was very embarrassing and it was very upsetting that someone would spend so much time and effort to discredit me and that's what they decided to do with their time for their campaign. But it also is a reminder about editing, because I went back and read the journal myself and I found entries about me, you know, doing volunteer work, campaigning for John Kerry, starting a activist group in my college.
I don't think the New York Post included any of that in their
and
coverage.
None of that was included, right?
Yeah.
So I think that we all have to just remember what the role of tabloids are. And I also was anticipating it because I remember they did it to Julia Salazar and I remember they did it to Jumanji. This is like a function of a dying machine, right? The political machine is always looking to discredit and humiliate people who are truly challenging them to do better. And I think that, you know, in a way, when that happened, I knew that it meant that I could win. So I think everyone should remember that, too. If you're suddenly reading about someone's teenage years in the tabloids, it means that they're doing well enough that they could win. And that's why it's happening.
Do you think we're going to see this more and more in terms of people trying to seize on a person's old digital footprint without some sort of protections put in place at either the state or federal level?
I think that it's a danger for other reasons, but I think that politically speaking, I think my case is a good example that it doesn't work and it's not worth your time and energy and money to spend resources hiring somebody to do that kind of oppositional investigation. I think it really backfired, and all it did was make people feel disgusted that someone was creeping through my teenage years online, because we all have that now. And I live actually in a district that has a dominantly young population. So I think that, you know, especially here, it didn't stick. So it might be something that we actually see less and less. But it is reminding me of the other reasons why we need digital privacy laws.
We're speaking with Emily Gallagher, who ousted a 48-year assembly incumbent in the Democratic primary this summer and will represent parts of North Brooklyn in January. You're in the process of hiring your district office, and I was intrigued by your selection criteria that you've publicized, which doesn't seem to be looking for a traditional legislative staff. Can you explain what you're doing and who you're looking for?
Yeah, you know, I think one thing I learned from my campaign and from working in, you know, arts-driven nonprofits from my adult career is that the skills that people bring that are really useful, you can't predict. And that people's life experience really helps them to sometimes do surprising things. So my job application is not for a particular role. I do already know who my chief of staff will be. So, well, to give the listeners some context, I just wrote a post to say, tell me what you're passionate about, what you are bringing to the table, how your life experiences have helped to drive, you know, your goal of community organizing and of bringing passionate change to our district and Albany in the future. And we're going to find out who's interested and then see what kind of team we can build that will be really compatible with each other. Because, you know, one of the things that I've learned is that district offices are very underfunded, and we have to make the most of a very little amount of money. So passion, drive, interest is all things that are going to matter to me far more than anything else. And as someone who believes in social justice, I want people who have different experiences with their housing, with their education, with, you know, their involvement in the system. As someone who is not a career politician, it would be really difficult for me to require that the people in my office had a certain kind of background. I think that it's really important that people are able to bring creativity to their role and to bring a perspective that is unique and is based in human experience and not necessarily in textbooks or status kind of, which is what we often see in politics. So I'm really wanting to shape new politics from the inside out. You know, we can't make transformative change if we don't actually act in a transformative manner ourselves.
And finally, considering how long your predecessor held the job, Are you planning on staying 50, 60, 70 years? What's your plan?
You know, I really am not. I'm planning to hopefully build some great community organizers in this neighborhood to work together with the community to kind of envision a new way of doing things. And after I've accomplished a few things, to pass it on, you know, and encourage people to take up the role. I don't think it serves anyone to stay in a job for that long. I know that is actually a difference generationally. And I know that my parents' generation were encouraged to stay with one job for their entire life. But I think in the world that we live in today, cross-training and bringing perspective and fresh perspective is really important. And I really want to make sure that I live my values by sharing the power.
So you're saying like 4 decades then? Just
do, yeah,
just
I'm saying
years.
Like, you know, I'll stay until I die in office.
Well,
you know, maybe like, you know, well, it all depends. I don't know what's going to happen. Hopefully people will challenge me in the future. And, you know, it's not, I think the main thing that I'm trying to say here is a lot of times in politics, people say, this is so-and-so's seat.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is it's nobody's seat, but that community's seat. And it's up to the community every 2 years who's sitting in that seat. I hope that my community will give me enough time to learn the ropes and get a few things done. But, you know, it is the seat of the community, and I'm going to have to prove to them time and again that I'm the one that belongs in it. And as long as they think that that's true, and as long as I'm being challenged and they're being challenged, we'll have a good match.
Well, we've been speaking with Emily Gallagher. She is the winner of the Democratic primary in the 50th Assembly District and will be the next representative for this North Brooklyn community. Emily, thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you. This is really fun. And I'll see you at Wegmans.
You've been listening to the Capitol Press Room, which you can take with you on the go wherever you download podcasts. Our engineer in Syracuse is Dave White. My producer in Albany is Tim Williams. I'm David Lombardo. Thanks for listening.
Join us again for Capitol Press Room, a production of WCNY Connected, Syracuse.